Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Today's episode is brought to you by the fine people at Equal Vision Records and their new release from Say Anything called I Don't Think It Is. So you probably like Brand New, Taking Back Sunday, Newfound Glory. You will love this record. I mean, Say Anything. They're a mainstay of our scene. It's awesome. So what you can do is go to sayanythingmusic.com, so the name of the band, music.com/podcast, and you get a discount, 15% off anything in the store from their newest release. The CD features bonus tracks, people, or they got shirts, posters, whatever you need to outfit your room or yourself with the Say Anything. So yes, let me remind you, I Don't Think It is the name of the new record. Say Anything is the band. And visit sayanythingmusic.com/podcast. Do it up. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 200th episode of 100 Words or Less. I'm your host, Ray Harkins. And the reason I'm emphasizing 200 is the fact that it's 200. That is a lot. And that basically, that's 200 hours of you hanging out with me on a weekly basis through the beautiful medium of podcasting. And I really appreciate that. Like, I know I say that every show. I really do mean it from the bottom of my heart or my gut or wherever, the bottom of something that is important to me. Because this thing would otherwise just be me talking to myself. But the show has built up enough steam and momentum that guests are coming to me. I'm able to interview people who I never really thought I would speak to in this sort of context and then have them take me seriously. And I don't know, there's just a bunch of beautiful things that have stemmed out of this this fun adventure that I decided to go on a couple of years ago. And I'm glad that you are along for this journey. So the 200th episode, I wanted to mark it in some special capacity with a really fun guest, an old friend who I just recently reconnected with. I met him. Oh, man, we actually go through where we met each other the first time, so I won't bury the lead. But Damian Abraham from a band called Fucked Up. He also does a side project band called Pink Eye, and he's a very prolific musician within punk and hardcore. And I mean, Fucked Up, like, kind of a big deal, kind of a big band. They've done a lot of amazing things. They've broken through the threshold of being just a hardcore band that's only playing to, you know, 150, 200 people a night, which that isn't a bad thing, obviously. But they, you know, they play like the Pitchfork Music Festival, and they play these huge things that many aggressive bands don't get the opportunity to. But Fucked Up definitely has. Like, I distinctly remember too, they did a 24-hour show in New York City where they basically played for 24 hours and had different vocalists, and it was just really funny. I remember seeing pictures of like Moby singing with them and deciding to do Vatican Commandos, which is Moby's first band, which is a punk band. They decided to do some of those covers, and I don't know, it's just, they're able to do a lot of cool stuff. And then Damien, he himself is a, to say he loves punk and hardcore is an understatement. He is a historian in so many ways. And he actually, I just appeared on his show that came out this week called Turned Out of Punk, which is a podcast where he does something similar to what I'm doing, except I'm hitting more of the, I guess, emotional beats of a person. And he is definitely honing in on the, all right, let's talk about the first 7-inch you ever bought. Like, what color vinyl was it on? And the minutia is awesome, and I love it. And I loved being on his show. And so we thought it was a good idea to kind of do a split 7-inch. So you listen to this interview, and then you go to his show and listen to my interview, and then you'll both be exposed to good shows, hopefully, you know? And if you haven't heard this show before, welcome. I appreciate that. This is exactly what happened here. So anyways, let's get some business out of the way, and then we'll dive into the conversation with Damien, because it is quite a long one. So strap in. I want to talk about, what do I want to talk about? Oh, yes, I do want to talk about some shows that I've seen recently. I went to see a band called Daughter, and holy shit, that band is unbelievable. I recently, maybe a couple years ago, saw them open for The National in Los Angeles, and they mesmerized me then, and now watching them in the atmosphere of a club was even better. Just so much amazing stuff. Let's do this as well with the John Bunch show. So I know I mentioned it in last week's episode, but the Sensefield Memorial was unbelievable. It was one of those things where it just felt like I was walking down a lane of musical history that I had lived in for most of my life, like seeing bands like Outspoken and Strife and Mean Season, and then seeing bands like Texas Is the Reason and Sensefield and Game Face and Sam I Am. Just all of these amazing people coming together for one unique event. And it was just, it was so special. Like, I know that sounds whatever, cliched or trite, but it really was, because we've all been affected by independent music in some capacity, and everyone celebrating that fact was just, it was a really special night. So there you go. There's some quick show reviews. And also, I'm on vacation next week. You will be getting an episode, because I'm that dedicated to keeping a regular release schedule. And next week's show is an incredible one. But let's not lose focus on the fact that we were talking to Damien from Fucked Up for the 200th episode. I actually joked around and I mentioned that to him. I was like, oh, I'm not really celebrating the 200th episode. And then he's just like, what are you talking about? And then we started joking around about it. But I decided to leave that part out, because, you know, you don't need to know every piece of conversation that I have with people. So anyways, here is my discussion with Damien, and I will talk to you after the interview is over, and I'll tell the guest and do some closing thoughts. So here is Damien. Let's do this. You're one of those people where it's like, you've existed in my life for a long time, and I can't even, like, if someone put a gun to my head and was like, when was the first time that you shook Damien's hand? I'd be like, I have no fucking clue. It's like, that's what I think people in punk and hardcore kind of, it happens with them at a certain time.
I weirdly think it was actually in Toronto. I met you at the Dine Alone office. I don't think it was in California. You were away when we were out there the first time, and then I think I met you there subsequently, but I think the first time we actually met was in Toronto.
You're totally correct. I remember, yeah, I remember, because I think I came in with the Cancer Bat dudes, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, yes. Then now that all comes back to me, because, yeah, what were you doing there? You were just hanging out?
It was funny, because I was just at Joel's, like, I was just there the other day, and I'm like, and you actually were talking about you, and we're talking about, like, you know, it's amazing how everything kind of goes in circles in our lives. But we were like, you know, catching up, and I was like, at the end of the thing, he's like, do you want to go downstairs and grab a record? And what I actually did when I was there is I was convincing them and helping them set up a vinyl department, because they weren't doing anything on vinyl at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, you guys got to do it. Like, it's really what you should be doing. And I went down to the record room afterwards, and it's like, my God, everything is on vinyl.
Right.
They have every piece of thing they've ever put out here.
It's I definitely feel a kinship to you in regards to that idea of, like, you see something that should exist, and basically, like, you don't care if there's any sort of, you know, compensation or monetary value to you. You're just like, hey, this thing should exist and you should do it, you know? Like,
yeah, like, to be honest, like, the reason I really wanted to do it is because I thought Moondog, the Walter Schreifels pre-Quicksand thing, mm-hmm. had to come out on vinyl, and my best way of doing that would be by convincing the people at Dine Alone, because they worked with Walter to put it out. So I hit them up and was like, hey, can you you know, I was talking to Joel. Actually, first thing he hired me to do was organize a CD collection.
Nice.
Which seems like an easy job, but that guy has, no exaggeration, I'm going to say 5,000 CDs. Like, and that's, and that's being conservative with how right. many CDs might be. Like, stuff like, there would be bands like Clutch, where, you know, I enjoy Clutch. You know, I definitely have their first 7-inch on Inner Journey Records, but my God, did he go deep with Clutch? And my God, does their catalog go deep?
Oh, it, like, does.
It is crazy. I'm like going through it. I'm like, holy, I have no, like, live records and stuff. So he hired me to do that. And then I kind of came into the office and was just like, you guys got to start doing vinyl. You got to start doing vinyl. And so I kind of was like doing that. And yeah, like, I really just wanted to see Moondog come out on record. And that still has not come out on record. So I failed.
It has not. And I think the Walter Sings the Hits should be also illegally pressed on vinyl. Via Lost and Found or whatever bootleg company that existed back then. I want to say that was We Bite, though. I think We Bite was the bootlegger on that.
Can you edit this part out?
Yes.
Well, because I'm going to give you the name of the person who did it, and it's going to blow your fucking mind.
Okay.
But you cannot reveal this, because this person has sworn me that, you know, when
sworn
I brought
to secrecy.
It,
yeah, sure.
Yeah. Steve Aoki.
Oh, dude. Okay. That's funny you mentioned that, because he was in Revelation doing an interview with Jordan Cooper, like, maybe a month and a half ago. And dude, he straight up told Jordan, like, he was like, hey, Jordan, like, I actually did those Walter Sings the Hits. And Jordan was just like totally nonplussed, was like, oh, okay. Like, wow. Just couldn't care less. But no, you mentioning that triggered my memory, and I was like, oh shit, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. If he's come out and said it now, because at one point he's like, you cannot, cause he's got a Gorilla Biscuits back piece tattoo.
He,
like,
totally
he's like, yeah. Like, you know, like, and so I was, when I met him, I was like, hey, I hear you bootleg Walter Sings the Hits, when I met him at Coachella. And he's like, he freaked out. He's like, no, yo, you cannot say that. I don't want to get sued by Revelation. Like, I didn't make any money off. I'm like, dude,
I'm not going to blow up your spot, dude.
I'm not going to blow up your spot. It's not like I'm, like, going to write a letter to, you know, the Rev Fun Fact. Right. Reveal that.
totally.
Which I do love, by the way, the Rev Fun Fact.
Oh, it's one of the best parts of that email.
It is my favorite thing to get. And sometimes, you know, they're hits and sometimes they're misses, but like anything else, but like the fact that they still do them, it's, my hat's off.
Oh, absolutely. The thing that I always found interesting in subsequent times, you know, we've spent in whatever, the same rooms and in proximity to one another, I always found it really interesting that obviously your band was always well documented as being, like, you know, you guys were like friendly with one another, but basically, you know, when you stayed at my place in Southern California, well, you didn't, you stayed obviously mm-hmm. with Bob Shedd, but it's like every band member kind of like splintered off and did their own things, which I always found honestly incredibly healthy, because it was always strange to me, like the guys in Taken, like they, you know, we would do our own things to, like, independently, but it was still like there was a lot of this stuff, like, you know, I was always the guy that was like, hey, let's go like see this touristy thing, and everyone else was like, fucking Ray, why are you bringing us along for this? But I just always found it really like healthy, that idea of like separating, because you spent so much goddamn time together in the first place. Like, was that, I presume that wasn't obviously like intentional, like I gotta get the fuck away from everybody. I'm sure at times there was, but was there kind of that splintering that always happened when you did get to a town where you had multiple choices to do things?
Well, I think it's really weird, because like no one in the band like was, we were all friends. Like Mike and I definitely were closest to each other, but no one was really like super, super tight. And then Mike and Josh became really good friends just before the band started. And so it was more like we just kind of came together. And there's like a brief period where we all collected records. I remember one time we were in Montreal and we all went to Primitive Records in Montreal and we're all buying records. And it was just like, it's a really great memory to have because it was the last time we were all pulling in one direction. So yeah, like, I don't know. It just kind of, I think, by an outgrowth of the fact that we're all such different people. And, you know, I think if you asked anyone that kind of grew up with us, the fact that we're still in a band together would blow people's minds because right. We're just like, none of us are the same sorts of people. And we're still like, we've even grown into more different people, weirdly.
Right.
Like, we yeah. found ways to be like, how can we be, you know, more alike, but even more dissimilar or even more, sorry, similar, dislike each other.
Right. Or have these, like, you know, widely different life experiences that obviously, you know, create a division between you, whether or not it's a, you know, intentional or unintentional. Like, you know, you being a father and it's like, you know, no one else in the band, I presume, has children.
Oh, Josh is two now.
Oh, God.
So there's, yeah, that changed the dynamic a lot because I think then it became two of us pulling in the direction of, well, let's slow down. Let's try and spend a little more time at home. Prior to that, it was me by myself.
Going.
So that life choice definitely influenced the way things were going in the band.
Right.
But I think, you know, now with Josh, things have changed. And I think also everyone in a band, it gets to a certain point where you know, unless you become that kind of road warrior type personality where you're just trying to find a way to stay home.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You're just like, hey, this is also a very fulfilling part of my life. Cause I do think there's that weird notion of like, you know, oh, because you stay at home, like, you know, you're not part of the crew or whatever. You're not doing the right punk thing. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like, these ideas are like totally mutually exclusive. It's like, I can do this other thing and still be like, you know, the same person just because I'm not spending, you know, 300 days out of the year on the road or whatever.
Well, I think touring, when I became like a quote unquote pro core band or a touring band,
right,
that's when it really changed the way I interacted with my scene. You know, like, I was no longer able to be the guy in the scene, or like the person in the scene, I should say, sorry. But because it was like, I was just, you know, I was away, you know, I wasn't, you know, keeping up on everything that was going on necessarily at home because I was away on tour a lot. So, you know, now with kids, it's also really hard for me to keep up with what's going on. But I think one day when my kids are off in college, I will re-enter my scene with a gusto because I will be at home and not touring.
Right. I like that. It's like, the, you know, people look forward to, you know, whatever, kids getting out of the house, you know, retirement, all that sort of stuff, to be like, oh, I'm going to like chill out. But you're like, dude, I can't wait to dive right back in.
Yeah, I'm gonna revive petty message board politics, and I'm gonna bring it all back.
Totally.
When I re-enter the scene in a big way,
you're like, I can't wait to relive the past glories of message board days past.
Yeah, exactly. The way back machine will be ripe for my picking.
Right.
I think that's like, you know, one of the you know, that was for me was a really hard thing to accept, was that I wasn't going to be, you know, especially at the point where we kind of like started touring, you know, like we were, you know, I felt like I had finally achieved my dream of being in a band in Toronto that, you know, was part of like the upper echelon of the scene, you know, like I could play the shows and have kids sing along. And, you know, I felt like I knew all the bands and everything, you know, it was like exactly, that was my fantasy when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, mm-hmm. You know, like my musical fantasy, I should say. And, you know, then, you know, once you kind of have to let that go because it becomes your job and you're like, well, because it's your job, you gotta tour. That's the only way you make money. And then you kind of have to let go of this sort of like perfect little kingdom you had constructed for yourself.
Right. Well, it's very interesting. I think that there was something I was going to ask you about later in regards to like identity, because obviously a lot of people that do, you know, start to become, you know, really active within their scene and obviously start to get attention. And, you know, that starts to, like, you are Damien from Fucked Up. Like, you know, mm-hmm. that is what people know you as. And like, obviously, because the band still exists, like, that is what you will be known by. I mean, of course, you know, people know you from the podcast now and obviously your Vice stuff. But was there notions of like the, I guess a feeling of like uncomfortableness where, like, well, yeah, like I am that person, but like, I'm also, you know, I'm also more than that and more than whatever reputation has preceded me or whatever.
Oh, sorry. The smoke alarm just went off.
No, it's okay.
In the background of you hearing that. Okay. You know what? I think I don't know. It's just like, you're right. Cause so much of my identity was wrapped up in like who I was as. It's my friend Maddie Matheson. You know Maddie Matheson, where he was. Yeah, it's my. He's cooking up a storm downstairs, so that's what you're hearing.
Nice.
I'm hiding away in a wardrobe upstairs, but you hear him screaming and it smells delicious, whatever he's cooking, but it's definitely
it's causing the kitchen to freak out.
Well, it's funny. I've got like a little hardcore ensemble below me. It's like Scott Wade's down there from former Comeback Kid lead singer and Maddie Matheson. So it's like, I still feel connected to it. Like that's the thing is like, I don't know. I think the punk rock side of me, you know, like the side of me that was the record collector, like, you know, me as a punk rock guy, it's a really good question because I think you're right. Like so much of your identity becomes established on what people interpret you are. And I think actually, to be honest with you, it made me a better person. You know, I think people envisioned me a better person than I was. And I think I tried to become that and I'm still trying to become that. You know,
interesting. So like because I do think that there's a struggle, especially when you are so readily identified with one thing when you're, you know, in your late teens, early 20s. Mm-hmm. And then when you have to sort of, you know, I wouldn't even say transition out of it, but transition to like obviously the fact that it's like, you know, you're the parents in your kid's school, like don't give a shit that you play in a band. Like when you have to like find your identity outside of that safe space is when kind of, you know, I find and I see like people struggle with that idea.
Yeah. It's weird. Like I think with the band, I never had to, it's funny. Cause like the band, because we had such a weird profile in Canada, people at my kid's school know who I am and almost like from the band. I think that it's more the fact that they think I'm definitely really good at doing stuff when it comes to music. And I have technical abilities, like I can come to the school and I can run music equipment for them, which I cannot do at all. Or I can do sound for them, which I cannot do at all. Mm-hmm. I think like now I'm finding that where I have to deal with the fact that, you know, like it doesn't matter who you are. Like as far as like, you know, I was this guy in this band that won a high profile award in Canada, but that's not going to pay my rent. This month,
right?
Or next month, you know, like and even people knowing who I am at the school like doesn't really help in that situation. Like I think, you know, the more the identity is the fact that, you know, like you spend the first half of your life kind of constructing, you know, this what you think you are and which way your life is going to go, and then you hit a point where you're like, well, I can't be that person for the rest of my life. Like I can't be Damien, the lead singer, fucked up for the rest of my life because my situation is not really going to allow that now with three kids. And, you know, financially, I just couldn't afford to do it, I don't think. And I think that's become an interesting thing for me is like, you know, people being just assuming that, you know, oh, you were in this band that won this award, you know, 5 years ago. You must be set. And it's like, no, I got to get it. I got to work every day. A job every day.
Totally. Yeah, there's that weird sort of entertainment industry perspective from people that have never lived in it are just like, oh, yeah, like you toured. It's like, well, you define tour as a much different thing than what, you know, you and I define touring as.
Yeah, exactly. Or like being on TV. God, yeah. I'm sorry.
No, it's but not.
Like, the idea of being on TV where someone's like, oh, you were on TV, you know, like, you know, you must be doing good. It's like, for like a TV show, you get paid like, you know, you get paid well, but it's not like you're shooting a TV show every day. And when I say you get paid well, it's like a few hundred dollars. It's not like thousands of dollars. It's not like you're making friends for $1 million an episode. Like,
right.
You're getting paid, you know, like, you know, $400, let's say, for a day, which is amazing, but you're not going to be maybe working for like 3 weeks, 4 weeks after that.
Totally. It seems also like the because do you have an older brother or a younger brother?
Younger brother.
Okay. It seems to me like the sort of I guess center of attentionness that obviously kind of, you know, gets thrown upon people that sing in bands. It seems like you kind of took to that naturally, but then you also have this side of yourself that is very you know, whatever, self-deprecating and like, oh, you know, I just want to be accepted. Like you were saying, the goal of being in the upper echelon of the scene or whatever. Did that sort of center of attention stuff, I guess, come easier to you, like the performance nature of it, or was that a learned trait?
I think it kind of grew out of the fact that it was just like, I'm just going to be completely free on stage, you know, like it was almost like an anti-performance in the very beginning. Like it would be like, and this sounds insane to think about it now, but I would go to the bathroom and I would stare at myself in the bathroom and be like, everyone here fucking hates you. And I would just say that over and over again and stare at myself in the bathroom and just psych myself up. And then I could go on stage and just cut myself open or do whatever was required to kind of like freak people out and to make it kind of a weird show. I think like being a fat kid was a lot of that, you know, growing up as a fat kid and being afraid to kind of like take off my shirt, you know, like I've talked about this before, but like I didn't take off my shirt till I had lost my virginity. You know, like I was just like, I'm just not going to take off my shirt publicly, you know, and I don't actually know what that's not even true. I had sex with like the first couple people and I kept my shirt on. So, yeah, like it was like a thing. Like I was like ashamed of the way I looked. So I think a lot of it was when I got on stage, it was just like, you know, well, fuck everyone. You know, I'm just going to go out there and be crazy and be negative. And I think over time, I kind of mellowed out. Very quickly, I think. And I wouldn't say very quickly, but, you know, over a few years. And it became much more kind of a celebratory affirmation thing. I credit seeing Andrew WK with a lot of it. Like seeing Andrew WK live for the first time, and Mike and I went there to kind of out him. We were like, we're going to out him as being this hardcore kid because we knew he was a hardcore kid. We knew he played in Cathode.
Right.
And Mike and I were going to interview him for Mike's fanzine. And, you know, we sat down, we interviewed him and realized that, oh, it's like, you know, and I don't, you know, obviously people are like, oh, it's an act, blah, blah. It is so genuine, whatever it is, you know, like if it is an act, it is the most genuine act I've ever experienced in my life. And if it's legit, it's the most legitimate, genuine experience I've ever had with a musician. But it was amazing talking to him and just like watching him at that show, watching the way he talked to every single person in the crowd. Watching the way everyone left that show feeling better about their day, you know, and their experiences. And I think that's when it began to transition for me. And it became less about, you know, I still wanted to freak people out. I still wanted to be weird and you know, like you're either with us or against us when you see it type thing. But at the same time, I started wanting it to be more like, if you're with us, I want you to feel better for the experience.
I like how you brought up Andrew WK because I do think that there is something that's so I remember like Taken played this thing called Furnace Fest down in I think it was Birmingham, Alabama. It was mostly kind of a Christian festival. But anyways, Andrew WK headlined and it was one of those things like probably to this day, I don't think I've ever seen a bunch of like punk and hardcore kids in one room like having so much fun, like totally like exactly what you're talking about. Totally unashamed, totally just like, you know, throw caution to the wind and not like a violent throw caution to the wind, like let's beat people up, but like you said, the sort of celebratory nature. And I do think that's it, that's gets lost in a lot of people, like you said, that are kind of, you know, losing the forest from the trees and being like, well, whatever, even if it is an act, like you said, it's still coming from this absolutely sincere place. And I think that's a really interesting point that you kind of that you learned from that particular evening, and it obviously provided, you know, more confidence on what you could do within the context of your own band.
Well, yeah, and I think seeing that show, you know, like it was men and women, racialized people, like all different sorts of people enjoying this, and it was very inclusive. And I just think the thing about hardcore is a lot of it becomes like talking about how inclusive it is, but then, you know, there you know, the exclusivity is what gives you a lot of strength, I find, when you're a younger person, you know, except. So I think that's, you know, you can end up putting walls up at a certain point. And I think, you know, seeing that show, seeing how, you know, and I mean, especially because it's a bro dude club a lot of times at shows, you know, and especially in Toronto at that point, it was definitely not a very hostile environment. It was a very hostile environment towards women at shows. And seeing this Andrew WK show, seeing, you know, women I knew enjoying themselves and just, you know, being able to kind of experience on the same level what was going on, and just kind of like, it just kind of made me reassess the entire, you know, environment I wanted to provide when I played a show.
Sure, sure. The reason I'm treating speaking to you a little bit differently than how I've treated a lot of other shows is because, obviously, I mean, since you have your own podcast, your history is very well documented as far as like first bands and all that stuff.
So I
apologize on the larger themes that I'm trying to hit on, but it's definitely just like, well, yeah, you know, you've talked about all this other shit 470,000 times, so I don't need to. Hey, so what was your first band? How did you come up with the name Fucked Up? It's like, okay, you everyone's got that already. The thing that I found so really, really fascinating, it partially just because obviously like every time we take and played Southern Ontario, we got ingrained in that scene pretty quickly as far as like the personalities and, you know, the people involved, obviously us becoming friends with Alexis on Fire. But the thing that blew my mind was the fact that it's like, you know, you yourself and then obviously all the guys in Alexis got thrust to this sort of like mainstream stature of, you know, like you said, you people at your kid's school know who you are. And it's like in the same way that like I so remember this is an anecdotal story, but funny nonetheless, where it's like I was up in Toronto doing something for business and I stayed with Dallas one night and it was right as he was dating or his now wife who was
Leia.
On Much Music. But it was hilarious because he was like, we were watching the show and he was like, oh yeah, like, you know, that's my girlfriend. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, just what do you, that doesn't make any sense. And he's like, no, that's like, she's legitimately going to meet us when she's done. I was like, I just didn't believe him. And then she did. I was like, what world am I living in? Like, it just was so bizarre. So I'm sure from your perspective, like once people started to pay attention to you on a weird mainstream level, was that tough for you to grapple with, or was that just kind of easy to like, well, I guess I'll ride this while it's going?
I think with Alexis on Fire, getting to watch it happen with them, and it never happened to us in the same level that it happened to them, obviously, because it's crazy. Like, and you know, Dallas at this point, it's like he's doing stadium shows or like band shell shows in Toronto this summer, like huge, huge, ginormous venues, which I know he's played before, but it just feels like, wow, it's like so weird to kind of watch. I think Alexis on Fire broke down a lot of barriers for bands like myself. Like the screaming barrier on radio was the door they kind of kicked in. And when it kind of, so when it started getting attention, when people started seeing us and recognizing me and stuff, I think it happened so gradually. And I think also, like when I say parents at the school recognize me and know who I am, it's not like every parent does.
Right.
And I think I got to experience it in such like small little pockets that it was just like almost like a charge for me. Like it wasn't like I ever had to worry about getting recognized to the point where I had to leave somewhere, you know, or harassed out of a store or anything like that, which I definitely, when I was with George and I'm sure Dallas it's happened with, that stuff is legit. That has happened. Mm-hmm. You know, but with me it never did. You know, I remember one time, I think it was like the first time a kid recognized me on the street ever, and it was after we actually had opened for Alexis on Fire. This kid came up, he's like, oh my god, you're in that band that opened for Alexis on Fire. And I'm like, yeah. And I just started talking to the guy, and then eventually it got to the point where the guy's like, yeah, I gotta get out of here. He's like, like clearly I didn't want to talk to you this long, buddy. So yeah, like for me, it was never, I don't know. I never really got, you know, unfortunate in any aspect. So yeah, like it always kind of felt more fun, you know, and weird, definitely weird. It never, never still to this day doesn't feel normal. Like the guy at the convenience store down the street from my house, which I've been going to for years at this point, you know, since I've been on, you know, being a VJ and all this kind of stuff on TV. And the other day, like 2 weeks ago, he's like, you know, we talk, he's like, hey, are you the guy on Vice who talks about weed? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, oh my God, someone from this neighborhood finally makes it. And I'm like, man, I'm making less than I did before.
It is funny how that just that definition of making it, where it's just like, well, yeah, like I'm on a web series on, you know, a very, very popular medium, but I don't know if I've made it, but thanks, I'm glad you're watching.
I really appreciate that. And then I, you know, and said, notice that I'm buying the smaller bottle of Perrier, not the big expensive bottle.
Yeah, notice that I'm not buying Pellegrino, I'm buying Perrier.
Yeah, exactly. I'm buying the President's Choice brand. Oh, you guys don't have President's Choice in America, but that's like our store brand.
Your and store actually, brand, yeah.
It's a pretty fancy store brand, so
right,
forget everything I said.
Yeah. And so I also think too that there has to be this this connection, the fact that there's no way that in the States, obviously, I think that, you know, notoriety for, you know, either yourself or obviously, like we were mentioning, Alexis as well, that couldn't have happened anywhere but Canada, in my opinion. Like,
I think England.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, like Bring Me the Horizon and stuff, like watching that kind of happen in England. And even with Alexis got huge in England too, and Australia too. But you're right, like it just seems like it would not be something that would happen necessarily in America.
Right, definitely. And obviously the trajectory of Fucked Up has been really interesting to trace, obviously, from the fact that, you know, for all stretches of the imagination, like, you know, you guys obviously have added layers and textures to your sound, but you're still just an aggressive punk band, and that's been obviously the through line for everything.
Yeah,
I found it so interesting that, like, obviously once the you know, indie world started to pay attention to what you know, bands of our nature were doing, I just found it so interesting, because obviously you guys and, you know, bands like Ceremony received a lot of shit for the fact that it's just like, oh, you're on Matador, like, you're real fucking cool, or whatever. Like, I'm just obviously mimicking the internet or whatever.
Yeah, I understand.
But like, I did any of that kind of, just because you were so hyper aware of everything, like, did any of that kind of bubble up to you and, like, bother you? Or was it one of those things where you're just like, well, we're making the decisions we're doing that are best for the band. Obviously, I'm not listening to, you know, internet tomfoolery.
I think, like, by that point, it, like, you know, it's like, you should have gotten to me earlier. You know, like, if anyone was pissed off at us by that point, like, the ones that hurt me was when it was kind of like, I remember we did Year of the Pig, and it was reviewed in Maximum Rock and Roll, and it was reviewed by Martin from, like, Limpress and Los Crudos, who's, like, a friend of mine. I love him, and I still love him. Like, no, you know, I've gotten over this now, but he hated the record and slammed it in such a way that it almost felt personal. And that was like, you know, like, fuck, he was like, you know, this band's going jazz and all this kind of stuff. And I just remember reading that, and that one hurt, you know, that one really, I was like, oh my God, like, what? I'm just trying to play. And we hadn't even, I don't think we had signed to, oh, maybe we had just signed to Jade Tree around that time.
Mm-hmm.
Just signed to Jade Tree. And, you know, so, like, around then, that was when it was kind of like it stung a little more, when it was people that I had known and people that I really liked Fucked Up in the beginning, kind of like in the 7-inch era, that when we did the J Tree jump, kind of were like, ah, oh, fuck this band now. I remember actually sitting in the car in, God, I can't remember where we were, but I was sitting and we were playing the new album rough mixes that we had just done for Hidden World. And Beav, who sings in the band Urban Blight, I think he actually goes by his real name, Michael, now Huntington, but the Beav, he will always be the Beav to me. And he's a key figure in all of our Southern Ontario bands, I think. Anyway, he's like, I like the version of this song you guys did on the 12-inch way more. When we were, I forget which song it was even. Like, I just remember being so bummed out. I'm like, fuck you, Beav.
Right. You're like, but we worked really hard on this.
We worked hard. Like, this took way longer to record than that other one. You know, but that's just like, and I think also I watched it happen with Tear It Up. You know, do you remember the band Tear It Up?
Of course.
I love that band. And just kind of like watching them just kind of grow as a band and do what they want to do as a band. And then just watching people like be like, meh, I like the old stuff more. Mm-hmm. You know, and you just can't stop that from happening. So, you know, rather than trying to fight it, you might as well just like enjoy the ride. And I kind of even got to feel like I was part of a canon of bands that experienced that now, you know, like I got to feel like I was in a, you know, part of a greater conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I totally agree. I mean, I think it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you're never going to be able to retroactively please all the people that have followed you since, you know, whatever demo tape first 7-inch or whatever. But yeah, all your only hope is to obviously add people as you're going along. But then to me, the more, you know, beneficial side of things is the fact that you can be sort of that gateway band that gets people into this whole subculture. And it's like, you know, one person randomly seeing you at some, you know, huge festival or whatever is going to be like, wow, like I really identify with that. And then clearly, because you wear all of your influences on your sleeves, you're gonna, like, they're gonna dive back and be like, oh yeah, I'll listen to No Warning, you know. But like that will be more of a calling card than just like, oh, like we're trying to play aggressive music, but you know, we really are just like indie rock kids at heart, you know.
Well, there's different archetypes of bands, right? Like there's like, you know, different types of like, I guess, punk and hardcore bands, you know. And for the longest time, my hope was we would be one of the obscure ones, one of those bands that, you know, put out a couple records and just disappeared and no one ever heard anything from them ever again. And that was actually like Mike's dream too, and Fucked Up. And we had a plan. They were going to stop Fucked Up and we're going to start another band called Get Bent. And Get Bent was going to be the real band, and Fucked Up was going to be the fake band that was just going to like be the obscure band that disappeared and never went on beyond a certain number of records. Like, this was obviously jettisoned very early on as a plan.
Sure.
But I think that was, you know, there's like that kind of like the romanticism about, you know, a band that's perfect because they never changed. You know, like my favorite bands are those perfect bands, like the H100s, who did 3 7-inches. And that's it, you know. And then they were like, they're frozen in time, perfect, and crystallized for me. And I think, you know, there's that sort of appeal to it. But then there's the other type of band, which is what we've become, which is, you say, a gateway band. And that's where, you know, you fulfill a different role. And your role is to be that band that lets people kind of find out about the obscure bands, because they can, you know, they're like, oh yeah, I used to be in that band, but now I'm into this obscure band. And that's, you know, every band's got its role. It's like an ecosystem.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We're sitting here. It's like June. And you're like, where has the time gone? And everybody's like, oh my gosh, I have no idea. I got to like accomplish all these other things. Take a moment. Focus on the things that obviously, for one, matter to you. But for two, look back. Be like, what have I done well? What have I done not so well? And maybe I can, you know, ask some friends and family for some help. But where I have always gone to in regards to figuring out what I can do better, therapy. Therapy is an incredible tool at your arsenal that you can dip into. I've done it for my marriage. I've done it for myself personally. And I'm a huge advocate for what therapy can do for you, because it is a third party that's able to look at what you can do to improve your life and be a person to help you along in your journey. And so I think if you were thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and entirely suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire, you get matched with a licensed therapist, and then boom, you're done. It's great. And then if you're not vibing with the therapist, you can switch it at no additional cost. So take a moment, reflect on the things you've done, reflect on the things you want to do, and visit betterhelp.com/ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ray.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
All right, check it out, people. I'm here to talk to you about Harry's Razors. And the reason I'm so excited about Harry's Razors is because they know what's up. they have disrupted this whole razor game business. So for those of you that are shaving, which is, I hope, most of you, you know how painful it is to buy razors. You know, they get you. They're like, oh, wow, here's like a $10 razor and three blades. And then you go back to the drugstore or convenience store and you're like, why is a pack of blades like $47? It's absurd. You don't need to do any of that. Harry's will deliver it right to you. They're delivering high quality blades, German manufacturing, five blade cartridges. They give you a close and comfortable shave. It's unbelievable. So seriously, why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades when you can get them for half the price at Harrys.com? And the Harry's starter set is an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and three razor blades. So normally Harry's doesn't like to do discounts. I mean, that's not their thing because the stuff is so cheap. It's direct to you. They cut out the middleman. But because their prices are already so low, we've worked out a special deal just for you, the listener. So go to Harrys.com, and then you get $5 off your first order. So Harrys.com, enter the promo code. This is important here, 100 words, the number 100 words, and you will get $5 off your first order. Seriously, I've been using the kit now for a good 2-3 months, and it's awesome. I'm able to shave with the grain, against the grain. It's beautiful. It's close, and I don't have to worry about wasting so much money on stupid things like razors. Well, to be frank, they're not stupid. They're pretty awesome because they make your face nice and smooth. My wife was even like, "Hey, like your shaving looks good. Like you don't look like you're a novice at this game anymore." And it's like, "Well, I got Harry's. I'm awesome." Well, I'm not awesome, but Harry's is awesome. Well, you get the point. Anyways, visit again harrys.com and then use the promo code 100 words. You will get $5 off your order. Just try it out, right? What do you got to lose?
It's definitely one of those things where you're not able to obviously see where you kind of sit until like opportunities start to get presented to you. Because it's like, you know, I don't think very many bands would look at the, you know, opportunities and the attention that you guys were getting and be like, oh, no, we're not going to do that. You know, well, out of every 10 bands that would do that, like maybe one would choose not to. And obviously, like you say, be that, you know, band frozen in time. But most of them would just be like, yeah, like, why not? Like, why would we not want to, you know, be on this cool legendary label that has a lot of things going on for it?
And we have friends that made that decision. Like, I know bands that were offered, you know, like, how seriously, and you know, I don't know, but like I do know friends that were in bands that were offered like other labels, you know, like the chance to kind of like make that quote unquote next step, you know. But like that, all those rules are out the window now in 2016. Like the biggest band in hardcore is a band with just a demo out, you know, and like the second biggest band is a band with just a 7-inch out,
right?
Like, you know, Gloss would, well, I guess they now have a 7-inch too, and then that band, Reeks, I'm fucking up the name, of course, but from France, are like, they're arguably the two biggest bands in hardcore, or Coneheads too, like one obscure LP that no one can get, and these are like the biggest bands in hardcore now. Like, I think it's like all the well, everything changed, right? Like, it's no, the cycle is broken in music. It's just the whole, all the rules are out the window. But yeah, like the old way used to be different, you know, about trying to jump to the cool label. But we had friends that didn't do that, you know, and I kind of like wonder now, like, you know, like, because the other thing is like when you have the opportunity presented to you, it's kind of like, well, I know what's going to happen if I don't go with this label. I know I'm going to, not going to, you know, I'm just going to fade away into obscurity. I'm going to keep doing my 7-inches and that's it. But then if you do, you know, like, who knows what happens? Like, you know, like we kind of were like, okay, we can do our next record on this label and it'll come out, you know, people might not like it. Like, we were going to make Hidden World and we were going to make Year of the Pig regardless of what label we were on. Like, those were just the records we were going to make. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we could have made them on, you know, the labels that were still okay to make them on. And, you know, people might have been like, eh, or we could make them on another label and people could be like, eh. So might as well just, you know, we know the result's going to be one way if we stick on the path we're on. Might as well try this other path.
Totally. Yeah. It's, especially because it's like that opportunity doesn't come to everybody, like you said. Mm-hmm. Another thing I want to hit on was the fact that obviously I love how you speak about Straight Edge, and obviously the fact that you're not straight edge anymore. there is a reverence that I think, you know, a lot of people don't transition to. You know, it's like they look at the thing of straight edge being like, oh, it's just that dumb kid shit I was into. Like, I don't know what I'm talking about. But like, obviously you, you know, you had every reason to not, you know, continue down that path and obviously introduce cannabis into your life. But I just wanted you to kind of, you know, unwrap that. Like, was that a... obviously, I know it weighed heavy on you, like when you decided to not be.
Oh, it's huge. Huge.
Decided to not be straight edge. But like, was it, did you shift immediately into that mindset of just like, oh, yeah, like straight edge was amazing. Like it you know, or was that something that you had to kind of like grow accustomed to?
No, I don't think I ever was bitter at all towards straight edge. Like, you know, straight edge didn't let me down. I kind of let straight edge down, you know, like that's the way I kind of look at it. Like it was there. And I like, I remember having a friend who did break edge a lot earlier, and he would say, like, you know, when people would say, oh, it's just a trend, you know, and this is like, yeah, but what a fucking amazing trend to be a part of. You know, even if it's just a trend for 10 to 15 years of your life, or like, you know, 5 years of your life, even, it's like, you know, as long as you don't ruin someone else's life and make someone else's life harder for them, it's like, what an amazing thing to be a part of. Like, what a positive youth experience to be a part of. And it's kind of like, that's the way I look at it, you know, like it's not obviously a youth experience because a lot of people, you know, are adults and straight edge, you know, and a lot of my friends are straight edge and stuff, like yourself. And so I still, you know, I still see the value it has in people around me's life. But I think for me, it's like, I have no regrets at all about being straight edge. Like I have regrets about being on the pharmaceuticals as long as I was without recognizing what that was doing to me. But I don't have any regrets about being straight edge.
I think you and I are the same exact age. You're 35, right?
36.
36. Okay. You're
young.
Yeah. I know. and you have two children. Now you have three from the recent birth of your, is it a son or daughter?
A son. Camden is okay. The latest.
And so
great.
You always had the intention that you were going to, you know, obviously be the family man, as it were, and kind of enter that? Or was that a sort of unintended, like, oh, so now I'm going to be a dad sort of thing? How did that all, just because it's such a weird notion for people that grow up within punk and hardcore to have kids, you know?
I honestly, I think I felt, I was thinking about this the other day, just coincidentally, you know, I think I always thought I would have kids. I always said I was going to have kids. But like everything in my life, I think the middle step was always missing. So I don't know when I envisioned myself settling down and meeting someone and getting married, because it wasn't like, it just wasn't in the cards. I didn't think at the time. Right.
Right.
And like, I didn't lose my virginity till I was like 20.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like I was like meeting a lot of people and like being like, oh, I'm going to settle down really quickly or meet someone. Like I didn't date a lot or anything like that. So yeah, I think I must have intended to become a father, because I would always say to people like, yeah, one day I'm going to be a dad. But I really think it was meeting my wife, Lauren, my partner, Lauren, and her and I just kind of like, it sounds so ridiculous saying it, but falling in love and then kind of being like, let's make children.
Right. That's the next logical step.
Yeah, I think that's more how it kind of, you know, because even though I would say it, I think I would just say it because that was the thing you said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like one day I'm going to have kids. And I didn't really know if I ever intended on having kids at the time. But, you know, then when I met my wife and well, I knew her for a long, long time before we actually started dating. But once we started dating and you know, fell in love, I was like, I want to have children with this person and bring children up. And then, you know, things happen and more kids show up and
right.
You know, it's like, whoa, you can keep getting pregnant and stuff right. Like that.
You got a brood now.
You got a brood. We have a team. We have Hanson.
Right. Totally. You are 3/5 of the way to a basketball team.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think it's going to stay 3/5 of the way there. I think we will forever have a 3-man bobsled team. I think there's going to be a snip and tie.
Oh, yes.
An operation, in the words of the Circle Jerks.
Right.
To make sure that there's, you know, every kid, I'm not, you know, no, in no way do I mean that none of these kids were, you know, loved and excited for them coming, but it was surprises when they were coming. at certain times. So
totally. I definitely got the procedure done 6 months after my child was born, because I was like, yep, I'm done, man. We're done. We're yep. Shop is closed, my friend.
I was going to get a procedure done. I probably would have got it done sooner, but I was waiting to get a pilot made for about it, and I was going to have my procedure done on TV. So I'm kind of glad that didn't happen. So I'm going to have to book a procedure.
Yeah, now it will be part of a television show.
Now it's not going to be part of a television show. Now it's just going to be part of the reality TV show called My Pathetic Life.
The thing that, you know, it was funny when I first became aware that obviously you were doing a podcast, because I think I've listened to since episode one. It's one of those things where anytime a new sort of music podcast comes up, that I feel is obviously, akin to or similar to what, I've been doing. Of course, there's always that immediate, like, oh, all right, let's sniff this out. Like, let's see if this is fucking good. Like, just that weird competitive nature, you know?
No, it's natural, you know? Yeah. And I think everyone feels that way. It's funny when you're in a band and, you know, all of a sudden that switch flips and you're like all of a sudden concerned about your spot in a weird way. Like, obviously, mm-hmm. I've moved much past this now. But I look back at certain points of my life where I was like, oh, geez, there was a moment where it stopped being like a band that was like gaining, trying to fight for my spot, and started being a band that was like protective of my spot.
Right. No, that's true. So
I can only imagine with the podcast too. It's the same way.
Well, yeah.
With a band.
Totally. You feel that sense of like, okay, like it's, and I think this is, I guess, where maybe the whatever maturity level rises up, where it's just like, okay, as long as it's like not this like carbon copy of this thing that already exists, then you feel like it's cool. And like, obviously what you do and I do is in the same world, but at the same time, like, you know, you're definitely focused on the minutiae and the details, where, you know, I'm obviously trying to be a little bit more emotional about it, as it were. But the thing that I guess endeared me to your show in particular, not only because I like you as a human being, but the content that you're getting out of these people, is obviously the obsessiveness, because I do think that there is something that is so charming about how obsessed people get with shit that is on the outside of the world, where it's like, you know, most people would look at either record collections or Dungeons and Dragons or whatever and be like, why the fuck do you care that much about that? I mean, is that something that obviously that was kind of like in the forefront of your mind when you started to kind of put the show together, just like explore that really detailed minutia, or is that something that was just a byproduct of obviously who you are?
I think it's definitely a byproduct of who I am. And just like the way I like to understand things is by, I have to see how it fits together. You know, like I have to know, like, when it, with bands, how they connect to one another. Like, oh, that person like saw that band and liked them, and that's why they became like this. I don't know. I've always been into that, and I've always kind of been, I think growing up in Toronto, Canada, I was like, you know, really privileged, because that's a super heavy media market. Well, I was privileged for a lot of reasons, but growing up in that media market, it's there's a lot of opportunity to kind of pick out stuff. Like, it was a major distribution hub for records through Viable Alternatives, which was Record Peddler, a record store in Toronto's distribution company. There was also, like, you know, actual record labels there, and other distribution companies over the years have been kind of hubbed out of there. So you kind of always had lots of records, lots of media, like free weeklies. So I like, you know, obviously I feel lucky that I stumbled into punk and I found punk, but, you know, and I found punk through this kid, Nick, that I went to, I was like learning how to be a summer camp counselor with when I was 13, and he told me about Sonic Youth, and that's how I got into it. But I kind of think I would have found out about it some other way. The thing that I've always found fascinating is, like, how did someone who wasn't from Toronto find out about it, you know, or how did, you know, someone get led on this path to getting into this music, because it's not always the easiest thing to like when you're growing up. I was also like Colt Cabana's podcast. He's like a pro wrestler who does a podcast called The Art of Wrestling, where he just interviews wrestlers about wrestling. And I was like, well, I want to just interview people in bands about liking punk music, or just people that I know like punk music about liking punk music. And a lot of these conversations I had with people backstage at shows, or like we would play a festival, you know what it's like, and you're playing a festival and there's like some band that you really like on it. So you're like, well, I'm just going to seek them out and punish them,
right?
Because that's what I'm going to do today. And, you know, and like, there's like many tours where like, you know, Jonah from Fucked Up and I have gone and just like harassed the dude from Monster Magnet because he was in shrapnel, or you know, I walked by Duff McKagan's dressing room one day and just like knocked on it and was like, yo, can we talk about the farts and the fastbacks? And he was just, you know, shocked, I think, at the whole experience. And that's the thing that I also noticed, is that as soon as you talk to these people and take them back to kind of like the moment of innocence, in the moment where like you got your most idealistic, which is kind of when you get into punk, I find, with most people, that's when you have like, obviously you're most cynical, but you're also your most idealistic about how the power of this genre, you know, is going to change the world and change your life at very least. And, you know, I find when you take people back there and you get them to talk about that stuff, it's a really easy conversation. Like, there's crazy people that I've had punk conversations with, you know, unfortunately not on the podcast, but you know, like, it's a weird story. I've told the story before, but, you know, like I was back, we were in Australia playing this festival, not a festival. Yeah. We were playing a festival. Sorry. But we were just backstage seeing the Foo Fighters on a day off. And I went backstage and I ended up, you know, talking to this dude with face paint on, and, you know, I was smoking weed with him. I'm going to out him as smoking weed with me. And I'm like, you know, he introduces himself. He's like, my name's John. And I'm shaking his hand. I'm like, oh my God, it's Johnny Depp. And like, I remember from like a Spin magazine article that I read that he had played in this punk band way back when, called the Fast Cars. They identified it as the Fast Cars. And I remember that kind of bumming me out, because there's like another band from Manchester called the Fast Cars. And I was like, oh, well, I don't know if you know how much of a head he was,
right,
taking that band's name. Even though it's kind of ridiculous that he would know about, in a pre-internet world, this random ass band from Manchester, but that's beside the point. So I was like, yeah, did you play in a punk band in Florida in the mid 80s called the Fast Cars? He's like, no, we were called the Z Cars. And I'm like, oh shit. So were you in a punk? And he just like, we just went down a path of talking about punk rock stuff, and then started talking about this band, the Screaming Sneakers. And it turns out, it didn't turn out. My friend had given me a bootleg the day before, the Screaming Sneakers 7-inch, randomly. So I just put down my knapsack and pulled it out and showed it to him. And he teared up and he's like, that's my ex-girlfriend's band. I can't believe you know them. That's crazy. And it was just like, you know, and I don't know what it would have been like talking to Johnny Depp about anything else, but talking about punk, it was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, we just like bonded immediately about it, and took it to a place where he like, you know, was like before any of this stuff happened, you know,
it's definitely I've always put it like, it's the great, you know, it's the great leveling where like, yeah, when you can pull that out of a person and realize that they were as obsessed with the same thing as you were at some point in your life. That's what it's like, because all you're doing is just relating to human beings on a very human being experience. And
absolutely. And I think with punk too, there's almost like a built-in safety valve of, you know, that this person on some level at some point recognized that celebrity was bullshit, because I think that's kind of one of the like pillars of punk rock. Like, you have to kind of recognize that celebrity is the most ridiculous edifice we have in this world, and it's just put on people, you know, and there's no difference between these people and you. And I think that's like really key to punk rock, because that's, anyone can be the band is the key to the whole thing. And you know, once you kind of get over the fact that the bands are special, it just ruins celebrity, I think. That's at least what it did for me. So, you know, anyone that was into punk, I think deep down has like that sense of, we're all equal, maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'm way overstating. I'm way idealizing punk people. Punk people, there's assholes and terrible monsters that are into punk rock. So, right. Fuck what I'm saying.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.
Well, because a common theme that I've been able to gather from all the, you know, speaking casually and then on the podcast as well, is like, it's just so foundational, because not only obviously it's happening at a time of your life when you're looking for identity and you're looking for something to attach yourself to, but then it's like these things that, you know, you learn when you're whatever, 14, 15, 16 from either political views or philosophical views. And then it informs you when you're like, you know, in your mid 40s, where you just think about like, oh yeah, like, I still do think that way because of, you know, propaganda or whatever. Like, it's amazing.
Propaganda is the best example to me, because I think, like, I learned about Angela Davis from propaganda. I learned about, like, Howard Zinn from propaganda. I learned about, like, fucking Noam Chomsky from propaganda. Like, I just learned about stuff outside of my worldview. Mm-hmm. Like, and I learned about people that wrote about things that I should go read about. And I learned about people that were doing things that were interesting and outside of punk rock. It just, like, it's such a cool foundational thing to get into, you know. And obviously there are terrible aspects to it, like, and negative sides to it. But I think, you know, at its best, it's such a, like we were talking about straight edge, it's such a great thing to be into when you're young, because it just shapes you in such a, you know, hopefully positive way, you know, and exposes you to, you know, for, you know, at best, once again, at best, a lot of positive stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the, you know, as you obviously started to, this is more so in talking about Fucked Up, like once you guys started to, you know, get recognition and started to be able to tour and stuff like that, when did you kind of make the shift in your head to like, this is a real band? Like, you know, this is something that is, and when I say a real band, as far as like sustainable, like, oh, like we can exist for longer than, you know, a couple 7 inches in a full length, and like, oh my gosh, we're actually getting paid money to do this. And like, when did that shift kind of come into your head to where it was like, oh, this is, I guess, what I'm focused on?
I don't think it ever did.
Okay.
You know, like, and I don't mean that in a, like, it did in the sense that, like, I always believed in the music we were making, you know, but I think it always, I don't know if it's the anxiety or if it's, but I can't ever feel like anything's there forever, you know? And so, like, I've always kind of, like, gone into it like this might be the last thing that happens, you know, like a kid, like, obviously not every single thing, because, right, like, sometimes you're doing a 7-inch before an LP. But like every LP, it feels like it could be the last one, you know, because you just never know. And I think that, and I think a lot of people are like, oh, it's a gimmick, and And some people are like, oh, you know, it's probably played up a lot. But there is like animosity between people in the band. And it does become unpleasant at times to be around. And I think once in a while, we need to kind of step away. And it feels like maybe this is the time that we're going to step away from each other forever. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also like, I don't know, like, you will it to be a reality at times. And I think Mike and I, especially Jonah as well, and Josh and Sandy too, are huge fans of this band Gaze from Japan, that is this Japanese hardcore band that's been around for, I guess, 35 years at this point, maybe a little longer. And they, legend has it that they only practice 5 hours a week. And that's the only time they spend with each other, except obviously touring and playing shows. And they don't really know anything about each other's personal lives because they don't want anything to get in the way of the intensity of the music. So this could all just be a legend and like, you know, like some sort of like thing put on Burning Spirits Hardcore by people in North America. But, you know, I think for us, it's kind of like the music is in the same way we like kind of look at Gaze as, look, it's more important to us than anything else. Like, we're going to keep coming back together to kind of to do stuff. Like, we're working on stuff even now. Like, we're on a break. Like, we're not even really doing anything, but we're still working on songs and working on stuff because I think there's still ways we kind of want to push what we're doing. And I think we would have been, like I said earlier, we would have been that band no matter what. And I think we're still that same band that we would have been no matter what. You know, we've been very fortunate because we've been afforded opportunities to kind of like to do things like record in studios and to kind of like, you know, live out our creative fantasies, as it were. But like, I think, you know, artistically, as pretentious as that is, we are still that same band that we wanted to be, or we were going to be at the very beginning. But it's always felt like it's the last time.
Right.
So, to go way long.
No, I mean, I appreciate that train of thought because I think it is.
I was lost in my own train of thought there. I apologize. I was just reflecting on a lot of things. It's always like it's weird because like if we had done this interview, I don't know, 8 months ago, I would have been like, it's probably the end. Mm-hmm. But now it, you know, we're working on stuff again and it feels like things are kind of like, you know, it's not we're working on things in the sense that we're going to go back out and
right.
trudge out immediately, but we're working on a couple
things are materializing.
We're working on some Zodiac stuff because we've always kind of said we're going to work on Zodiacs regardless. We're just going to keep doing Zodiacs just as a way to kind of, you know, keep at it no matter where we're at as a band as far as LPs and touring and whatnot. Right. So we're working on some Zodiac records right now and it feels, you know, kind of interesting and exciting again. So it's like, oh, yeah, it feels different. So
right.
Sorry if I got lost in my own train there.
No, I mean, it's great because I do think that within your you know, contemplation there, I think there's something that is so inherent with band life and obviously pursuing artistic, you know, endeavors is the fact that once you buy into the thing being the thing, that's when it's, you know, that's when a lot of ego comes into play because it's like, not only are you celebrating obviously yourself in some capacity, but then you're celebrating the fact that you're like, oh dude, like I fucking made it. I'm making money off this thing. Like, and I think when you do make that logical and logistical jump in your own head, that's when sometimes it becomes, you know, it gets out of your control. And it's like I've definitely noticed within the context of your band, like you've always maintained that control to the best of your ability because of obviously all of those things that you were talking about, which is, you know, it's a hard balance to pull off.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Like, I don't know if we've always been that successful in maintaining control of the situation, but I think with us, it's like, I think we just realized very early on, you know, like we're students of the game, you know, it comes back to what you're saying about this podcast being like a reflection of who I am as a person. And I think it's like we're all kind of the same sort of people in this band. Like we're all nerdy obsessives, you know, and now we've all blossomed into weirder people as adults, but you know, we were all kind of on similar paths, different paths, but similar paths, you know, and the way we kind of like approached information and I guess knowledge was kind of like very similar for all of us. And so I think we were just students of the game, you know, and like looked at other bands and have always just kind of looked at other bands and looked at bands we liked and kind of looked at how they've handled themselves and things that they've done and bands that we liked what they did and bands that we were like, oh, well that might be a mistake doing it like that. And, you know, we've definitely stumbled into a lot of the same mistakes that other people have, but I think in other ways it helped, you know, us figure out some things and prevent us from making some other mistakes.
The idea that because this was never, you know, your band was never the intended like thing to be, you know, your sustaining force and what have you. Like, did you have a notion of obviously like as you started to, you know, go through school and like start to explore career options? did you have ideas of what it is that you wanted to like express yourself? And were you, I mean, obviously you're attracted to the creative arts, but did you think that was a thing that you could try to explore and be sustainable?
I think I would have loved to have gone to art school. I think I was way too insecure to do that about stuff. I love drawing. I love making art, you know, and I think that is ultimately, thank God, fucked up and popped up and became the thing in my life because I've been able to kind of pursue making art for a good number of years now. But I think that's what I would have been much happier doing. But I was kind of on the path to, I would tell people like, oh, I'm going to be a lawyer, you know. But once again, it's like, I don't know. I was just saying that. Like I was saying I was just going to be a family guy one day. I was going to have kids one day. Like I don't think I had any comprehension of like what that would entail. So I was like going through school. I met on this like rock photography exhibition thing that I was working on while I was in university. This guy, Moses Neimer, who runs Much Music in Canada, and he told me to drop out of university. I mean this in a way, like he suggested I drop out of university and come work for him and be a VJ. And this would have been like, I was like 20 at this point, and like so it would be like 2001. And so I dropped out of university and, you know, started calling him, and then it never happened. So I was working in a video store. I was working in a video store and a candy store at the time. And they asked me to join Fucked Up. But like, yeah, like I don't know what I would have wound up doing. Like before Fucked Up went full time, I was working in the mailroom at Unilever, like that giant corporation Unilever. And mm-hmm. That was a pretty awesome job. I've never been as well read. I read like 8 newspapers a day. I would eat Ben and Jerry's ice cream because they owned it. Like right. One of the multitude of corporations they owned
right.
Was Ben and Jerry's and Lipton soup. So I'd have free soup and ice cream every day for lunch. I was pretty stoked about that. You know, that job was pretty good.
Right.
You know, so I don't know if I would have been wound up doing that. But who knows? Like that, I think that's, I really feel like as much as I kind of have bemoaned Fucked Up over the years and never made it where I thought it was going to be, you know, this is be my career forever, you know, I'm really grateful for it because I don't know what I would have been doing otherwise.
Right. And did your parents, where does you pursuing the life of obviously being in a band sit in their heads? Like did, especially with the name of the band, it's not like there's anything that they could really
no.
point to as being a badge of pride where it's like, oh yeah, like David plays a band called, oh god damn it, like how did that evolution of the relationship go?
I think our parents in this band run the spectrum as far as their acceptance of the band and the band name. My parents have always been really accepting of it and of me doing it. Like they obviously wish I had a different band name, but I don't think they ever thought it was going to be my career or it was going to be what I was known for. And then by the time it was what I was known for, they were really proud. My dad played in that band Gentle Giant before they were Gentle Giant. He played in like some weird R&B band. He was the drummer. He got kicked out because he had no rhythm. And I inherited much of that too, I think. That was the, you know, my mom was, when she was like a teenager, was on a TV show in Montreal called Like Young that was kind of like American Bandstand, but they had like a troupe of dancers that would come in and dance on TV. So that was like my parents both had like ambitions of the rock and roll lifestyle. So by the time fucked up became a real thing, they were just always really proud of it. I never felt anything but kind of creatively supported it. My dad would tell me, "Oh, you know, the names, you're not going to go anywhere with the name." But he also once told Damon Albarn from Blur the same thing about his band.
So your dad is basically dumb when it comes to band names. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, if my dad tells you to change your band name, keep it.
Yeah, just go ahead and ignore that advice because it hasn't worked out.
Start making t-shirts that day.
Yeah, get the get all your social media properties taken care of. Yeah. Get the website registered. You're done.
Yeah, no, my dad is amazing and I love him. He's like he is my favorite visual artist. Like his illustrations incredible and stuff. But at the same time, yeah, not one to turn to for the band name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And sorry, I know I mentioned that there was one last thing, but I did want to speak about your like you mentioned the anxiety that you felt, obviously, as you were growing up. I mean, partially due to your weight and a lot of the struggles that you felt with that. Like, there was something that I wanted to circle back on too in regards to that, because obviously, like the singers of bands, I mean, I can personally attest to the girls are instantly attracted to you because you get up there and are a thing, you know, regardless of what you look like. Because obviously, you know, people have been like, "Oh, Mick Jagger, I can't believe that guy is who he is," and it's like, well, yeah. But as you started to obviously, become a focal point of the band and people recognized you for that. And, I know you're obviously in a committed relationship, but I'm sure you had to have noticed like the attention that was being put on you in ways that you probably weren't used to. Was that like a struggle for you to kind of like grasp in your own head?
Yeah. Like, I don't think it ever really happened for us, you know, or maybe I'm just oblivious to it, or I don't think I ever put out any kind of, or I tried as best I could to never make any of that vibe there for the band. You know, like I just wanted to be as fun an experience as possible. And I think also Fucked Up in general, like, you know, and obviously people in Fucked Up, you know, every other member of Fucked Up probably, you know, enjoyed life a lot more than I did. But to me, Fucked Up was the most asexual experience on life and still is. In life, you know, and I for me, it was never really about that. It was always just about, and I don't mean that in a way that, like, you know, like people that are hit on are courting it or anything like that, or right. But I mean, it just never happened for me, and it just never, I don't know, maybe it was the environment, or maybe it's just me not being very attractive or something, but it was just never, you know, like a lot of bears liked Fucked Up and were into Fucked Up and stuff, and that was awesome. And, you know, meeting a lot of bears made me feel really good, because, you know, growing up, I didn't really have anyone, you know, express, certainly not en masse, attraction to me, or say that I looked sexy.
Sure.
You know, I think that was the other thing. I can remember all the sequence of events that led to me taking off my shirt. And I now know it's a staple of Fucked Up shows, and I even get shit when I don't do it.
Right.
At this point. But I didn't take off my shirt at all. Like I told you earlier, I didn't take off my shirt for years.
Right.
And then we played this one show in Albany, and the fucking drummer of Limprist, he's my friend.
Yeah.
He grabbed my shirt and started ripping at the collar, and it was my Maryland's Vitamin shirt. It was actually the first Maryland's Vitamin shirt that they made. I wish I still had this shirt. And it ripped right off. He did give me a police line shirt for it, but it was a medium, so it didn't fit me. But anyway, I'm digressing again. And I just remember being like, I can still remember the feeling, like looking at the audience, like expecting people to start laughing at me or something. You know, right. This is the middle of, and Fucked Up was already like kind of a band at this point. Like we had, I think Police was out probably by this point, uh-huh. I would imagine, maybe being the Public, you know? And I was just like, holy shit. Like, I can't believe I just had never had my shirt off really in public like that. Like I'd gone swimming, but it was, you know, it was just because I guess I had gotten given a lot of shit for it as a kid, you know, like. And then so we played another show a few weeks later in South by Southwest in Austin, and Scott Moore from Limprist came up to me and he's like, "You look really good with your shirt off." And I just couldn't believe anyone had ever said this to me.
Right.
Like, what? He's like, yeah, you look great with your shirt off. And it was so hot that night of the show. And there's video of it. You can see me pacing back and forth on stage. It's at Chaos and Taos Fest. Not Subway Subway, sorry, Chaos and Taos Fest. And I'm just pacing back and forth. And I just you see me just take off my shirt. And by that point, I was in it, you know.
Right.
But that was really when it kind of happened for me, where I just was like, I'm free. It was like my Tommy moment.
Sure.
You know, well, like, fuck this. Totally free. And I've been bleeding on stage. I've been cutting myself up on stage. You know, I was fearless about that shit, breaking bottles on my head.
Right.
All that ridiculous behavior. But, you know, wouldn't take my shirt off.
Right.
So still had my hang-ups.
There's the fact that you felt free at that one particular moment for, you know, taking off a garment. It's like that. I mean, that is a liberating feeling, and I can understand why it would have been such a big deal for you to accomplish it and then be like, oh yeah.
Yeah. I think that, and then once I started doing it, I just was like, well, first of all, it became a lot easier to play the shows because I was, you know, bigger at the time, and it was hot. A lot of shows were very sweaty. But it also became a moment of empowerment. Like, I'm going to force you to look at this. Everyone in the crowd, look at this.
Right.
And this is what I look like. You know, I have hair on my back, you know?
Right.
And it's
enjoy it.
Yeah. Enjoy it and revel in it. And then people did. And it was, and then it became something I couldn't stop doing.
Right. And so, and then obviously you do the podcast with your shirt off too.
Yeah. I do the podcast now with my shirt off no, but my pants are definitely off normally when someone's there, just sitting there in my underwear in my room with them, just right, trying to make it as awkward as possible.
Right. Here you are. Here's a wall of vinyl. Yeah. Here's me in my underwear. Let's talk.
Me in my underwear and my cat. Let's talk. Right.
Well, Damian, thank you so much. This has been really fun for me and something.
Oh, Ray, thank you.
Very, very, like I said, it was a challenge because you've obviously put a lot of your life out there. So I was like, okay, I'm going to skip around to the emotional beats as opposed to the obvious question. So I appreciate you.
Yeah, no.
I appreciate you being introspective and reflecting.
Well, it's funny because, like, I think with Fucked Up, there's always been this thing in the beginning where Mike wanted to keep it as mysterious as possible, you know, and very much like, you know, there's like, you know, a fake manager, and there's all sorts of intrigue around the band. And I've always wanted to be as honest as possible, because, like, to me, the most empowering thing about this music, punk, hardcore, you know, anything in that kind of world, is the fact that it is so honest. At best, at the best of times, but, like, the fact that you have bands talking to you directly and not speaking to you directly through their songs, you know, and the fact that they're doing that. And, like, so I always hope that I try to be as open as possible.
Yeah.
With this stuff. So,
well, I appreciate that. I'm glad we have this forum to do it, Ray.
I appreciate you having me, and thank you. Love the podcast, man. And, like, thank you for putting up with me and the fire alarm and all sorts of, all the different, locales that have been, required to make this. It feels like we've made, Ishtar.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely Ishtar.
Hello. Welcome to the outro. Who welcomes an outro? Anyways, that was the fun discussion I had with Damian. And we actually did this over two separate times because he got pulled away when he was at work and you heard the fire alarm, and it wasn't because of that. He was safe and everything was okay. But yeah, he just got called because he does a lot of stuff for Vice, and he was doing, I think, more of his weed content for Vice, which is, gosh, I can't remember the name of the series, Cannabis something, but you can easily Google it if you are so interested. I personally am not, but if you're a fan of the weed culture, he's got you covered on Vice. So, yeah, but hopefully you didn't notice too drastic of a difference between the two conversations. And so, yeah, I sliced them together, did some digital magic, and here we are. So that's that. Anyways, thank you very much for listening. You can visit the show 100wordspodcast.com, where you can access the show archives. So that means you can see all of the guests on one convenient player do that. And that way you could share it easily with other people and stuff. I also want you to email the show, 100wordspodcast@gmail.com, and 200 shows. Just, I'll give myself a pat on the back. And also give you, the digital listener, a pat on the back. You feel that?
Hopefully I didn't distract you too much. Hopefully that was not too creepy. That was a fun pat on the back and not just like, you know, the creepy uncle that sometimes comes up and like, hey, buddy. It's like, whoa, what are you doing? So anyways, the guest next week, as I told you that I would tell you. So here I am telling you is Cliff Nesterhoff. And I know most of you are like, what? Who's that? Cliff Nesterhoff is an author. He wrote a book called The Comedians. He also appeared multiple times on Mark Maron's WTF podcast. Basically, the dude, that book is unbelievable. If you even have a passing interest in comedy, you'll love this book, because basically he traces the lineage of, you know, vaudeville, like early 1900s comedy, all the way up to modern stand-up. And the stories that he unearths are unreal. Because it's like he's looking at the Variety archives. When I say Variety, I mean like the magazine that covered the entertainment industry during that time period. And he's just like finding all these stories, talking about the mob influence on comedy. I don't know. I could go on for a while, but I won't, because I'll do that next week. So yeah, Cliff Nesterhoff. And the reason that he's coming on is because he has a large history within the context of punk and hardcore, which I was able to kind of glean from the book. And then I hit him up on Twitter and he was like, oh, sounds great. I would love to appear on the show. So boom, there you go. There's a little behind the scenes magic. Anyways, I will talk to you next week, where I will be on vacation in San Antonio and Austin, Texas. Fun stuff. And yeah, so that's that. And I will talk to you next week, everybody. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo! Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sarge, High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at High Five Casino.
.com. High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.